Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
You know, for any given expenditure, we have to say, well, what does this do for the citizens of America? Like, how is this good for the people of America? It's their money.
That was the voice of Elon Musk in the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, as we welcome you in on this New Year's Eve. It is, what, 12:04, so Ranj wanted me to make sure that I wished Happy New Year to our loyal listeners in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, and Calcutta, India. Yeah. Thank you for being loyal listeners of the Chris and Amy Show. Well, we played that clip from Elon Musk because there was recently a piece by Jonah Goldberg in The Dispatch about Elon Musk's God complex. And joining us now is Jonah Goldberg. He's the editor-in-chief and co-founder of The Dispatch. He's an LA Times columnist. You've seen him on CNN, a political commentator for CNN, and a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And I personally just happened to be in the middle of his second book, The Tyranny of Clichés. And he joins us now. Jonah, thank you for joining us, and Happy New Year.
Hey, it's great to be here, and Happy New Year to you as well.
So we played the clip from Elon Musk earlier, and you wrote a piece for The Dispatch about what you called his God complex and his favorite motto, Vox Populi Vox Dei, that the voice of the people is the voice of God. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that, if you could expand on that, because there might be those who maybe aren't fans of Elon Musk, but think, hey, we could use some... We could cut some government spending.
For sure. And let me just say, like, there's rarely been a public figure I am more torn about than Elon Musk. Like, I'm not a big fan of Vivek Ramaswamy, but, like, Elon Musk is this incredibly impressive guy in the private sector. I mean, the SpaceX stuff is just amazing. The Tesla valuation may be, I think, a little overdone, but still, it's just this incredible accomplishment. You know, so, like, private sector Elon Musk, I'm really, really impressed by, with the exception of how he's basically run Twitter and a little bit on the Doge side. We'll see how that plays out. I'm cautiously optimistic on the Doge stuff. My only point about the Vox Populi Vox Dei thing is he loves to say that. It's one of his favorite slogans. And all it means is the voice of the people is the voice of God. Well, that, you know, is actually a pretty blasphemous idea. God doesn't follow polls, right? God, you know, like if public opinion mattered a lot to God, then Sodom and Gomorrah wouldn't have been destroyed. Noah wouldn't have needed an ark, right? I mean, like it's basically, I'm an Old Testament kind of guy, but even in the New Testament, it's God's way or the highway for the most part. And so what he does is when he uses that, he basically does polls that he knows are going to be come out the way that he wants them to. I'm not saying they're necessarily rigged, but they're not remotely scientific, and they're like his super fans respond to him. And then the polls go the way they, you know, these Twitter polls go the way they want. And then he says, Vox Populi Vox Dei, as if the verdict of a very online, very committed bunch of super fans on Twitter is the voice of God. And it's a stolen base theologically and sort of intellectually. And now he's gone further to basically say that Twitter is the new media and that it has replaced the mainstream media. I hold no brief for the mainstream media, but like Twitter is not the media. Twitter is, or X or whatever, is what it is. And so, you know, I just think it's a lot of silliness, really self-indulgent, and kind of, very loaded bad faith stuff, and it just drives me a little nuts.
You know, it's funny you say that. He only puts up Twitter polls that he thinks will go in his favor, and they do, except for the one that said, yes, you should not run Twitter any longer. He lost that one, but he's still running it. He's still running the website. do you think, and again, he is a smart person. I think we all get that. But do you think there is a disconnect between people who voted for incoming President Trump and people who may not want Elon Musk to be in charge of all of the things he seems to be in charge with in the incoming administration? Or do you think there's a lot of overlap there?
This is one of the reasons why I'm conflicted about the guy, because I think it's all of the above, right? I mean, there are a lot of people in MAGA who like Elon Musk. That relationship and that sort of embrace by Musk helped Trump win. And Trump understands that the money Musk spent, the support on Twitter, were important to him winning. I don't know that you can ever prove it was, you know, but for Musk, he wouldn't have won. But, like, Trump understands that there's a thing going on there that he owes Musk. The problem is not so much that, I mean, that there's the conflict between people who voted for Trump didn't necessarily vote for Musk to be sort of co-president or anything. The problem is that Trump's coalition is just really small. And we saw this with this recent fight about skilled immigration, you know, visas, H-1B visas. There are a lot of people in MAGA world who are very just anti-immigration soup to nuts, right? They just think the whole scheme would just shut it down for the time being until we can figure this out. They think they've been told that the H-1B visa system is a scam, that we're importing, you know, Indians to replace Americans. It's not America first, blah, 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 blah. And then there are other people who, like Musk, think this is sort of an essential program. If Trump had a majority in the House and the Senate of like FDR style or LBJ style, he could afford to like screw over one side in favor of another. But his coalition is so small, it's like 2-3 seats in the House. It's a very difficult thing for him to handle. And at the end of the day, you only have one president at a time. And I don't think that Trump can let Musk win every political battle for the next 4 years. So at some point, they're going to come at loggerheads and disagree about something. And what will be interesting is to see how many sort of MAGA-affiliated Republicans, how many core Republicans side with Musk over Trump over time. And I don't have the answer to that. I don't think the majority of them will. But, you know, if 10 people take Musk's side on, say, the immigration stuff in the House, or I should say, must I take Laura Loomer's side, right? Take the anti-all Indian immigrant side, which I think is fundamentally kind of a racist position, but that's beside the point. What can you get through on immigration in the House if you only can afford to lose one or two seats? That's the kind of dilemma Trump has, is he's got a very narrow coalition and a lot of people who think they own the right to define Trump's mandate.
Jonah, you had another really interesting piece in the Dispatch. The economy doesn't care who is president. And you mentioned that even amid a microeconomic boom, people live in macroeconomic boom, people live in microeconomic circumstances, because we hear so much about the economy. And I think Vivek Ramaswamy was saying, "No, we're gonna lose the war here. America's falling behind." But you had some pretty startling statistics about how well the American economy is doing.
Yeah, so the American economy has been at the macro level has been doing phenomenally well the last 30 years. I mean, just blowing away the competition. Financial Times, The Economist have had these special sections about it, about how we're leaving Europe in the dust. Big chunks of, like, basically if the United Kingdom was a state in the United States, the only state that would be poorer than it in a per capita basis is Mississippi, which is our poorest state. 15 years ago, United States and the EU were at essentially economic parity. We're now like 50% larger than the EU. I think those are all important statistics for people to keep in mind. And I think, you know, the Biden people got very frustrated by talking about how good the economy was doing, given coming out of the pandemic and all that kind of stuff. But my point about people living in a microeconomy is that the big picture numbers don't mean a lot to you if your cost of living has gone up 20%. And for a lot of normal Americans, they are literally poorer today than they were at the beginning of the Biden administration because of inflation. And so you can't tell people not to believe their lying eyes or their lying checkbooks, because people know their own economic circumstances better than you know, some expert in Washington or on the set on cable news. That said, you know, people who think this is the worst economy ever, people who think we're suffering more than we've ever suffered, they're just flatly wrong. The median American is a lot richer than basically anybody else in the world, except for a handful of really tiny countries like Switzerland or Monaco and that kind of thing, Singapore, where, you know, the statistics don't really work. But we're the richest large country in the world by far, and we're getting richer. And we live in this sort of kind of weird bubble in the way we talk about stuff, where we don't really appreciate how much better we have it than other countries. And I think that there's some good in that in America, is that we're not satisfied. We work harder than any other country, any other large country. You know, we want to do better for our kids and all that. But part of that drive comes from thinking that we're actually worse off than we really are.
Yeah, there was recent polling post-election that suggested people were starting to feel better about the economy, even though nothing has really changed. I mean, nothing has changed since the early part of November. So a part of it is a messaging issue, and I envision that it's going to continue this way. The people who voted for the incoming president are going to think that he's doing a great job with the economy, regardless if prices come down or not, right? Why is it so difficult? Why is the media landscape so difficult to break through with certain messaging?
Yeah, that's basically one of the reasons why this is such a stupid time to be alive. Just insofar as, like, you know, and this is did not start with Trump. You know, this happened under Obama, where basically just a sort of tribal partisan loyalty. People will change their positions and their perspectives on the whole country based upon who's in office. And that was part of that column, was just this, there is this myth. It's sort of a cult. My colleague Kevin Williamson has been arguing for a very long time that the cult of the presidency is really a form of idolatry. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if the king is robust, then the crops will be great and all that kind of stuff. And it's not how it actually works. This economic boom that we've been going through for the last 30 years, or the last 100, however you want to call it, whatever you want to start the date, It's varied between between Republican and Democratic administrations, between Democratic Republican control of Congress. We have a massive economy in this country, and the President of the United States doesn't have some machine where if he presses the right combination of buttons, it creates jobs. And the problem is that, you know, I think cable news is a big part of this problem. I think the sort of disintegration of the mainstream media, where basically all media now is sort of like niche media. It's looking at small audiences rather than like big, broad, you know, diverse, ideologically diverse audiences. And people are telling their audiences what they want to hear. And what they want to hear is that when the other party is in control, everything is going to hell. And when our party is in control, everything's going great. And that's, I get it. You know, if you're going to follow politics like a sport or entertainment, that's a very natural way to talk about things. But it's a really dumb way to understand the economy and or foreign policy or any of that kind of stuff, because that stuff is not contingent just upon whether or not the president has R or a D after their name. Mm-hmm.
Jonah, you have your podcast through the Dispatch called The Remnant, like purposefully named because it's a smaller or dying group of conservatism. Do you think this next presidency with Donald Trump will show that he has indeed reshaped, restructured the Republican Party into a monolith under his shadow? Or do you think it will show that there is more division among the Republican Party than we currently are seeing?
Yeah, so I think it's you know, just in defense of the title of Remnant, I don't think necessarily where it's it's, what are they saying, Spinal Tap? My audience is just getting more selective.
Okay.
But the point is, the idea of a remnant actually comes from, is a biblical term, and it basically is both that thing that's sort of left behind, but also it is the seeds for regrowth, right? So I am a firm believer in, whether you want to call it Reaganite conservatism, Buckleyite conservatism, National Review conservatism. I was at National Review for 20 years. And I think those ideas, those arguments are right. And if you think that they're right, that means over time you will be proven right. So long term, I still think, you know, I have my remnant has the better argument. That said, it is obviously true that Trump, as a political matter, has reshaped the Republican Party in all sorts of ways. Not always deliberately, you know, not always according to some master plan, but he's had remarkable success. I think the fact that Kamala Harris was so awful helped a great deal, and that Joe Biden was a failed president really helped a great deal, but, you know, he has to get his fair share of credit for it. I don't think the Republican Party is anything like a monolith now. You can't go far right now insulting Donald Trump, but, you know, that recent budget deal, you know, Trump took a very strict, you know, very severe position, saying we're in a primary, anybody who disagrees, and he couldn't get like almost 40 congressmen to vote with him. That is a sign, right? Basically, the Republican Party is looking more and more like a 19th century party these days, where it's got a lot of factions and it's a coalition of different interests. There's still people like, you know, the Wall Street Journal and Elon Musk who are about, you know, much more free market economics. And then there are a lot of people who are, you know, sort of skewing more to like the J.D. Vance side of things, where they're, you know, talking about industrial policy. And so it's not the Republican Party I would prefer, but I think there's a lot of room there for debates about the path forward. And the fact that Trump is going to be a one-term, essentially lame duck president, you know, from the get-go, means that we're going to see a lot of old-style, intra-party, factional fighting, like we saw with the immigration debate last week. There's going to be a lot more of that.
Jonah Goldberg, editor-in-chief and co-founder of The Dispatch. You can read his work in the LA Times as well and see him on CNN. Thank you so much for your time today, and Happy New Year to you and everyone at The Dispatch.
Happy New Year to you, and thanks for having me.